This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
This introductory chant is always, to me, rather appalling because it talks about the Tathagata's words. And so I asked a speaker about that, and he said, well, anything that's happening is the voice of the Dharma, so don't have to worry too much about you yourself being something especially that. Anyway, here we are. this is, so to speak, the end of a short workshop we had on calligraphy. And the words that I chose to work on are on a passage from the Xing Xing Ming. So you might turn in your chant book to page 21 again. Xing Xing Ming, the title is usually translated, the first word is trust or faith, and the second word is heart or mind. And the third word is, here it's translated as song. It can be just a writing or a notation or something like that. So some people don't like the word faith because it sounds too Christian religious. So the use of trust is preferred. This book, which I have appreciated reading, is called Trust in Mind. And he feels trust is the best word to use. And it's rather a remarkable statement, just that, because here we are in our cultures. Usually we have great classics, and some of those classics we have great appreciation for, and sometimes confidence in, and sometimes faith in. In the West, we have faith in the Bible, for instance, believing that it's the Word of God. And here, trust in mind. So it's trust in mind, not in some classic writing, but in mind. And then whose mind is it? Well, it seems to be our mind. How can we trust our mind? Well, we're using it all the time, so we seem to have some confidence in our own minds. Somehow you decided to come here today, and so your whole the whole result of your mind's decision it's resulting from this apparent confidence you had in your mind that it was working well and that it had some reason to make this choice. So we already have trust in mind. And so this this work called Trust in Mind is, we could say it's a refinement or an exploration of how that might work. This was written by Sengtsen, who was supposedly the third patriarch after Bodhidharma was considered the first patriarch of Chan Buddhism. And then Hui Ke was his disciple. And then Sengtsen was the third patriarch. And this is said to have been written by him, but there are, of course, questions about that and so on. But in any case, it was rather early. It was Tsang died in 606, so this was probably written just at the end of the 6th century. And it's considered one of the various ways that the Chinese mind received Buddhism from India. When Buddhism came to China, it had rather already elaborate forms and philosophies and many, many ideas, and it had also, of course, a way of practice, which was, let's say, oriented around the monastic life of monks. So when Buddhism came to China, there were, of course, it's a completely different culture. So there were all kinds of reactions. And of course, Chinese being Chinese, everything important always has originated and came from China. So even the Buddhist teaching at some times, it was felt that Lao Tzu was reincarnated as a Buddha, so that his understanding could be spread throughout the world, or could be communicated to people of a different culture. So there were some writers and monks when Buddhism came to China, they understood it in terms of Taoist thought. For instance, even the term Dharma, which is so central in Buddhism, was translated as Tao. And so it was very easy for the Chinese to seriously consider Buddhism, because they could see it through the mind, or through their sort of Taoist tradition. So the Xingxing Ming is one expression of this sort of collaboration, you could say collision and collaboration of a profound product of India as it reached into China. And the very strong terms or phrases that the Xingxing Ming has, for instance, the very first one, the great way isn't difficult for those who are unattached to their preferences. Now, we all have preferences, and our preferences pretty much determine what we do in our life. But the key word here is unattached. And then another basic point is a little below the halfway point. We have don't keep searching for the truth. Just let go of your opinions. So when Buddhism came from India, it was formulated in many statements, profound statements, and when people became Buddhist practitioners, they would sort of naturally be inspired by various of the statements that they had heard or had read. And that's the reason that they perhaps that wanted to become a Buddhist, in addition to perhaps seeing teachers or monks who were inspiring in their way of living or in their personality and so on. So don't keep searching for the truth and just let go of your opinions. So in the West, we're always asking why this and why that. And we often get answers. But any of those answers we should receive with appreciation, but not just take them as gospel truth, we might say. Now, the phrase that I chose, one reason I chose it, that we all practice, we learn these characters, we learn to write these characters. And one reason I chose it is because the characters are not all terribly complicated. some of the phrases I maybe would have liked to have used, but the characters were so complicated that it seemed defeating. So I chose this one, and I think it is also very representative of the Xingxing Ming. So it's at the last line of the second paragraph or the second grouping. But because you select and reject, you can't perceive its true nature. So that's what this is translated as. But because you select and reject, you can't perceive its true nature. So in regular traditional Chinese writing, you read the right hand side from top to bottom and then the left side from top to bottom. So the first character up there generally has something to do with good, positive, or beauty. And the second character, you can sort of see it has to do with the origin of something coming out of a seed. And so it has to do with cause. And then this one, curiously enough, this is an ear and this is a hand. And if you are, I think this has to do with growing up, maybe growing up in China, the parent grasps you by the ear if you're maybe doing something bad. I don't know. Anyway, to grab by the your grasping or your taking is the idea of this one. And this one, I don't know why it comes to mean rejection, but this is to reject. On the left side is hand, and right side is sort of like a putt. But anyway, it has come to mean to reject. So here we have taking or even just choosing, and here we have rejecting. And then in the upper left, those two together mean something like therefore or moreover or something like that. And this character, Supposedly, originally, it was a bird flying up into the sky, and it means not or negation. So the only thing I can see is the bird disappeared into the sky, so it is not. And this one, this is perhaps one reason I really chose this grouping. This character here is quite fascinating. On the left, we have woman, and on the right is mouth. So, what does a woman's mouth produce, or what does the woman say? Well, this is always translated as either thus or like. But also in the Buddhist context, it can mean suchness or the nature of things. So this comes from the mouth of the woman. So here we are in the middle of this hugely patriarchal system, both in philosophy or mental construction and in practice with all the monks. It's all patriarchal. And yet, the essential point is suchness, the suchness of things. So, because you select and reject, you can't perceive its true nature. So, not true nature, or not its suchness. Now, regarding the calligraphy, I put this writing here up. This is usually translated as number one. And it's when you study calligraphy, this is the first stroke that you ever write, usually. And it's very simple. All you do is go left to right. But if you're going to do it well, it might take you a day, a week, a month. It might take a year before you can ever do a good number one. And this one isn't particularly beautiful or fantastic. It's just very simply just the movement of the brush from left to right. And one reason it is so elaborately mounted and so on is because it was written by the abbot of Nanzenji Temple in Kyoto. It's one of the big Rinzai Zen temples. So he's a very important person. So whatever he does, it's worth appreciating. So it's being appreciated. Well, there's a very interesting comment in this book. It's regarding language. When Sentong's poem and other Chan texts are using the language of traditional Buddhism, they are placing themselves within the doctrinal context of Mahayana Buddhism, which is what came from India. When they are using the language of paradox, it is to place themselves within the freewheeling tradition of Chuang-Tzu's Taoism. In the mature tradition of Chan, we find a creative synthesis of two basic Indian Mahayana ideas of shunyata and upaya, coupled with the Taoist hermetic notion that chopping wood and carrying water are the most miraculous of activities when these activities are done non-dualistically. Chopping wood and carrying water. So this Mahayana ideas of shunyata and upaya are pretty among some of the basic terms in Mahayana Buddhism. Shunyata is usually translated in English as emptiness. And emptiness is pretty popular in a way, I think, nowadays. Of course, we don't like the term emptiness because it sounds so hollow and sort of negative. But if we use the term void, that sounds even worse. And one of the problems, of course, is that a term like emptiness or void, it sounds like some kind of a space or thing. And it's good to see a term like this as also kind of verbal. It's a kind of activity or a being, sort of, or a movement, rather than something that we're going to sort of get or be in, find ourselves within, or something like that. So one example is that emptiness is sort of like a bubble, and you can see initially you can see the outside of the bubble, and then if you go inside the bubble, then there's nothing there, or it's sort of like zero. And zero seems to mean nothing, but if you put a zero there and then you put a one next to it, then it seems to have a function. It seems to be doing something. And if you put two zeros and a one, it's doing more or less or something. So this emptiness is emptying doesn't sound too helpful either. So the point is that the mind trying to think hard about these things, it's not really that useful. So here's in our modern era, we can come across a comment like this. In our modern era, I mean, in which where we have in the deepest sort of sciences, where we have quantum physics, where they keep exploring the nature of reality, and everything that they pinpoint as the final, this is the source, this is the foundation of all matter. And when that is examined, then it's found to be empty inside, and there's just more energy. It's not empty in the sense of nothingness, but it's there's energy involved, and yet the energy is constantly changing, and then there's smaller little energy particles, so to speak, or energies in that. And so it goes until you get to the next one, which we are trying to investigate. Of what is the body made? It is made of emptiness and rhythm. At the ultimate heart of the body, at the heart of the world, there is no solidity. There is only the dense. So recently, one comment I came across, which has been animating for me, is that existence is poetic. And I'm sure many of us, when we think about our existence during a certain time, it was anything but poetic. It was just pure misery or pure some kind of grinding, painful experience. But of course, even poetry is not necessarily joyful. Poetry can also be reflect the pain and suffering that you're going through. And many of the greatest poets seem to have been people who somehow managed to appreciate their suffering in a very nourishing, ultimately nourishing way. So, if we see existence as poetic, maybe that helps us to understand what poetry is. Or it may help us to broaden our sense of existence. When we think about existence, it's easy, I think, a term like that we can see it, that it's not just a thing. It does have a verbal aspect, or a sense of motion or movement within it. Some dancing is possible in existence. So I think considering existence may be helpful as we're considering things like emptiness or any of these other main terms that pop up when Buddhism is being discussed. So when something is poetic, it's not not particularly linear. It seems to go in various directions, and it can be quite surprising. Unexpected things happen, and it's not ruthlessly logical either. And sometimes, instead of meaning, we could say there's a kind of intensity that happens, or a focus that we feel. Rather than a meaning, which sometimes meaning is something that we are happy to glom onto and sort of keep. And that's exactly what we're trying not to do, not to hold, not to grasp some unchangeable truths, but to be open to what this understanding might grow into or evolve. So I think that's plenty of words for a morning after all your quietness. So thank you. If you have any comments, please feel free to share them. Yes.
Mike.
Mike?
Is there someone that could read those characters in the Chinese that can understand, can read those in Chinese? I'd like to hear them in their Chinese. Does anyone in language? Anyone say them?
Please.
两有取舍，所以不如。Could
you do it again?
Yeah.
Yes. 两有取舍，所以不如。
No. Thank you.
Yes.
What comes into your mind when you look at the one?
The one?
That calligraphy.
Well, it feels like foundation of everything in a way, because it's from here everything goes. It's very interesting compared with the number one in the West, which is vertical. But this feels like more of a foundation basis of things. How about you? What do you feel when you see that?
Similar, but also thinking about the one is all one, and I'm pretty sure that the calligraphist chose to write this thinking about similar thing as one is the foundation. This as yeah, foundation is as a one, as the everything, as all, as nothing. So yeah.
Yes.
I was wondering, Mike, why do you know why you asked that question? Or were
the
you
sound,
asked?
The sound?
Yeah. What was that? Why? Why did you?
I wanted to hear it. I wanted to hear it. That's all.
It's different than reading.
Huh?
It's different than reading it, right?
Yeah. Maybe I could follow up with another question. Jerome, you started to talk with the word thusness. So I feel like this whole thing encapsulates thusness, and the last character is that word thusness. I think those of us that have some familiarity with Buddhism, we're familiar with that word, but I think for some too, thusness is kind of doesn't go anywhere. Could you expand on the word thusness a little bit?
No words are better than.
What's it sound like?
Thus. As it isness, or something like that.
Well,
things as they are, or
yeah, I think it's useful to realize that it's referred to because you select and reject. So, if you suppose you see this and you say, oh, I don't like this book. I'm just looking at it. I don't like it. So then you're reacting to, you know, maybe the color or the print or the size or something. And so by rejecting it, you're not really letting the book itself be. So the being of the book is sort of lost because you're looking at certain elements that you're rejecting. So this in itself is not really there. You're looking at blue, or you're looking at whatever it is that causes your rejection. So the suchness of this book is lost.
Because we didn't just let it be itself, something like that.
Yeah.
Who's rejecting?
It's another question. Yeah.
or what is rejecting?
Okay. Yeah, the rejection, your rejection is not just you rejecting it, it's your whole history. You had a terrible time with blue and you're feeling blue and so on. So so it's the rejection is coming through you, but it's much more than just this you.
There's a saying that I like somewhere I came was if you can let go of all judgment, if you allow things to be just the way they are without judgment, what would happen?
You see the true nature.
Well,
you see the true nature.
You
see the true nature.
Yeah, I guess, or this is similar in the same circle here, right? Of rejecting, not so easy.
Are there any people online who are wanting to comment? Yes, Jackie.
I just really appreciate what you've been talking about today in terms of existence is poetic and unpacking kind of what poetic means, or you know, it made me think of, you know, when you study philosophy, Western philosophy, it's not really poetic. It's let's get really clear on what this concept is, and that concept, and the other concept, and then we can kind of juggle them and see how they clash against each other. And it just, you helped me to really get clear, you know, in an empty sense about understanding in a different way, how we can understand in a different way, considering a whole realm of feeling that is not able to be discussed in a philosophical manner that way. And yet we discuss, right? So my question is fumbling towards how do we communicate with each other around our discoveries or our experiences of poetic existence? Do you have anything? I mean, you've been doing it, you've been exemplifying that right now, right? In your talk. And it communicated to me. So I just wonder about how we communicate with each other in this way, as opposed to the dry academic way, you might say, which is useful for other things, you know, I'm sure. And I really loved that you brought up quantum physics, and you just hit all my favorite bits to think about. So I thank you for that.
Yes, certainly that if we have a pretty positive energy in when we are in dialogue with someone, then the spontaneity that comes out is much more poetic than carefully reasoned argumentation. So the spontaneity, I think, is something that is really valuable.
Right. Thanks.
Yep. Yes.
When you talked about the calligraphy, the one you said to master it could take a day, a week, a month. What is mastery?
Well, it's I think it's beginning to appreciate what the brush is really capable of. And certainly as Westerners, when we write this, we want to draw a line that's as perfectly horizontal as possible,
mm-hmm.
and no deviation, and so on and so forth. And when you write with a brush, it's more reflective of the musculature of your body. So you see, it has a kind of curve
mm-hmm.
to it. It's and it slightly rises to the right.
Mm-hmm.
It's just reflecting the body itself, and so of course the body is involved, and then the brush itself. You compared with a pencil. Pencil is just two dimensional. You go, you know, left and right and top and bottom. But with a brush, you also go into the paper and up mm-hmm. from the paper. So it's much more sensitive to the writer. So learning what a brush can do is it takes a long time. And traditionally, in both calligraphy and then in painting as well, in the Far East, the traditional mode is to copy examples, and you copy and copy and copy various examples, and then finally you really have a good vocabulary in your musculature and so on, so that then after you've studied for however long, then you can really express your own being through that. Except that in many cases, people are so, they become so, what would you say, sort of devoted, but it's also sort of so deeply submitted to whatever they are following that they never can get out of that.
Get out of the copying?
Yeah. They always think somebody else's work is far better than theirs. And so they don't have this energy within their self-expression where they can really write with this strong vocabulary which they have received.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the problems. But if you can get beyond that, then you can be quite effective.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I understand that, like, selection, rejection, and intentionally chasing after something is not the ideal state of mind. But how do you think is the correct balance between selection and, like, taking everything and doing nothing?
Yeah, the important thing is here not, what was it, not being unattached.
Mm-hmm.
So you naturally, you can sense your own preferences or your dislikes coming up, and you can sort of try them out, but just not feel that this is the only way. And because if you have a very strong opinion of yourself, then your way is going to be the right way. But if that becomes a little less powerful, then you can appreciate. Can appreciate something you have chosen or rejected, and then but you keep an open mind that things might change,
mm-hmm.
and they often do, of course. Yes.
Maybe a follow-up comment is regarding the translation of the fourth word in that sentence, the rejection. But I think my interpretation or translation usually is more like give away or let it go for that word. I don't feel like there's a right or wrong side for the translation, but I feel the attitude is a little different because mm-hmm. rejection is more, you know, stronger. I decided to reject it versus let it go. My attitude is more calm, more peaceful, like I will just not care about it, etc. So I think that's the fascinating part. People could have different interpretations about a single wording. I think that's the interesting part.
Good, yeah, thank you. Yeah, I've often heard that it's true not only of Chinese poetry, but a lot of poetry that if you have three readers of a poem, then you have three different poems because people really appreciate or understand the meaning or the intention differently. So yeah, thank you. That's good. Anyone else online? Yes, Randy.
I think I pushed the right button. What word came up to me when you mentioned emptiness is that's always been kind of a hard concept to grasp, but I what came up this time was just sort of a fluid openness. And I started thinking of the arts and, you know, the poet with their words and their editing and going over and what's it going to, it's not set in stone, or a painter painting, you're ready for the next moment and what comes up. And then, yeah, we, in some ways we try to carry that into our everyday lives a little bit. And yeah, it was just a fluid openness, and I'm not sure if that resonates with anyone, but yeah, that's all I had to say. That's what just came up of the word sunyata, sunyata,
sunyata. Yes,
sunyata. Okay.
Oh, good. Fluid openness. Yeah, thank you. Yes.
The calligraphy movement that looks like a zero, but it's never quite finished. Does that mean zero or it's like this?
Oh, it's called the Enso. The Japanese monks often write that. Yeah. Yeah, it's open to lots of interpretations. I don't think it means, I think most people don't think of it as zero to begin with, but that can come into it as well. But it's an expression of fullness.
Before the one, and then feel like this dance that we're talking about, that existence is after that, but before the one and all the life and energy that changes comes before the one. And that's where I see the dance before that happens.
Mm. Sounds like you're about to make a painting or something. Can you show us when it's?
Sure. Teach me a few more times.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.